Sí, de acuerdo. Vamos dar início ao nosso primeiro painel, a política externa portuguesa e a resolução de conflitos, para o qual temos a honra e a colaboração do deputado José Lamego para moderar este painel, o que desde já agradeço em nome da Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros. Teremos como orador o Dr. Roberto Matthews, da Fundação para as Relações Internacionais e Diálogo Exterior de Madrid, pelo que daria a palavra para uma apresentação e início do debate ao deputado José Lamego. Tem a palavra.
Muito obrigado. Eu queria cumprimentar o Sr. Presidente da Comissão de Negócios Estrangeiros e Comunidades Portuguesas e também o Sr. Dr. António Figueiredo Lopes, diretor do Instituto de Estudos Estratégicos Internacionais, os senhores representantes do Corpo Diplomático, militares e os meus colegas deputados, naturalmente. E apresentar-vos o Dr. Robert Matthews, que é investigador na Fundação para Relações Internacionais e o Diálogo Exterior em Madrid. O Dr. Robert Matthews tem um doutoramento e é especialista em História Latino-Americana pela Universidade de Nova York. É também um especialista, naturalmente, em política externa norte-americana e, nomeadamente, em matéria de conflitos. O tema que ele hoje nos traz é uma reflexão de fundo sobre resolução de conflitos num momento onde essa matéria começa já a aflorar no debate público. O envolvimento de forças portuguesas em missões de peacekeeping é um facto caracterizador do nosso perfil de política externa, nomeadamente desde 96, com o envolvimento na missão de peacekeeping na Bósnia. Estamos no Kosovo, estamos no Afeganistão e numa posição muito específica, sem ausência de caveats, o que tem sido sublinhado em termos da percepção internacional, mas esta presença é hoje já objeto de alguma discussão pública por parte de setores de opinião e de pessoas de personalidades que entendem que eventualmente haverá um envolvimento acima das nossas possibilidades e uma sobrecarga para as nossas Forças Armadas. Muito recentemente, um anterior Presidente da Assembleia da República exprimiu a sua opinião nesse sentido. Obviamente, como moderador, não me compete expressar opiniões pessoais, mas não é essa, de modo nenhum, a minha opinião. E, de facto, como já em 96, a questão, quando se tratou da participação na missão de peacekeeping na Bósnia, alguns setores que tinham uma conceptualização mais conservadora da nossa política internacional acharam que era inadequado e que nós nos devíamos restringir, por razões que eu não sei quais sejam, a missões de peacekeeping em áreas onde tínhamos uma presença tradicional, nomeadamente nos países de expressão portuguesa, e aí nunca houve qualquer polémica interna ou qualquer dissensão interna sobre a nossa presença em Angola, Moçambique ou Timor-Leste. Sobre isso houve um grande consenso nacional, mas quando se tratou em 96 de enviar uma força para a missão de peacekeeping na Bósnia, houve uma discussão. Repito, penso que com esse envio se deu um sinal de modernização das nossas ambições de política externa, de assunção plena do nosso papel no quadro da União Europeia. Portanto, esta é uma matéria que não tem um interesse meramente atual, que não tem um interesse meramente académico, é uma matéria que toca diretamente definição e decisões concretas a serem tomadas a curto prazo. Para além disso, no atual Tratado de Lisboa, que eu espero, como europeísta convicto que sou, que que venha a conseguir uma ratificação e uma entrada em vigor no próximo ano, existe uma cooperação estruturada permanente que vai ser um elemento não apenas da identidade de política externa e de defesa da União Europeia, mas que servirá a uma estratégia de estar no coração da construção europeia, estratégia essa que tem sido objeto de consenso dos governos portugueses, nomeadamente desde o início dos anos 90. Portanto, estivemos em todos os exercícios fundamentais da construção europeia, no euro, em Schengen, isso teve implicações também em matéria de política de estabilização e consolidação financeira internamente. No meu entender, devemos fazer um esforço para estar também envolvidos na cooperação estruturada permanente no quadro da PESD. E, portanto, isto vai exigir um esforço, nomeadamente em matéria de política financeira, em matéria de política de defesa, mas também em matéria financeira. Mas penso que, e sem, de novo, pedindo-vos desculpa por estar aqui como moderador a exprimir opções ou opiniões pessoais, isto vai ser um fator definidor do nosso posicionamento no quadro da construção europeia e também do nosso estatuto enquanto parceiro na construção europeia. Temos-o definido como um parceiro previsível em matéria de construção europeia. Há quem acuse Portugal e os conceptualizadores de política externa de quererem jogar o papel do bom aluno, mas não se trata de ser bom aluno, trata-se apenas de ser fiável e previsível. Eu acho que uma matéria de fiabilidade e previsibilidade é, de facto, cumprir aquilo que se espera de nós. Neste momento, já cumprimos uma tarefa de curto prazo, que foi a ratificação do tratado. Espero que, quando o tratado estiver em vigor, isso compete, de facto, ao Governo, mas no contexto de um debate nacional mais amplo, que Portugal faça parte deste exercício, que é a cooperação estruturada permanente no quadro da política externa e de segurança e defesa. Portanto, eu não vos incomodaria mais no enquadramento deste tema, porque ele vai ser feito do melhor modo pelo Dr. Robert Matthews, a quem eu muito gostosamente dou a palavra. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado. Bom dia. E muito obrigado de novo pela oportunidade e pela honra de falar ante a Assembleia da República de Portugal. E muito obrigado também ao Instituto de Estudos Estratégicos, meu castellano está interferindo, internacionais. My experience with Portuguese began many, many years ago, more than I care to remember, when I was 24 years old and crossed the border of Venezuela into Brazil, and from there took a Piper Cub driven by a Portuguese pilot smoking a meerschaum pipe, I remember, to Boa Vista, and from Boa Vista to Manaus, and down the Amazon to Belém, and then I hitchhiked from Belém to Curitiba, a trip of 6 weeks which gave me the basis for what I know in Portuguese, but it was a long time ago, so I'm going to switch now into my mother tongue, which is English, and deliver my remarks, because I think we'll all be more comfortable if I do it in English. I was thinking of a title of this talk, and I couldn't come up with anything more inspirational than the responsibility to contribute. And it is a very general title, but I would like to get more specific in my remarks about the quality of that contribution and not only what needs to be done, but how it might be done. Today we're fortunate not to be living through the terrible European and world wars of the 19th and 20th centuries. But if the nature of the conflict has changed, the devastation and suffering from local wars, violence, and confrontation continues in dozens of conflict zones, affecting millions of people in the world. In addition, millions more suffer from a variety of deprivations that attack the most basic human needs and psychological and moral well-being. The international system, which has operated to prevent another world war, is nevertheless a fragile creature to address today's conflicts. Let's look at the problem. We see it every day in the papers. The most recent, perhaps in our memory, is the revolts over food prices and food availability in some 40 countries that shocked some of us into an awareness of the precariousness of our international system in terms of providing even the basic necessities of life. The increase in food prices points up three relevant issues. First, that although we have seen scientific advances and experienced pervasive modernity, we live in a world still beset by basic problems such as the daily problem of inadequate access to food. We have not made the kind of inroads by the 21st century against the terrible plague of hunger that one would expect from our otherwise highly technological development. Second, that the globalization of the economy, markets, finances, and labor is not providing a decent life for hundreds of millions of people, and that because of or despite of this economic global interconnectedness, the weakest strata of the world economic and social chain are being impacted negatively. Third, that there is often, but not always, a link between economic privation and social injustice on the one hand, and conflict, violence, and insurgency on the other. We live in a world in which old problems, poverty, hunger, inequality, unemployment, lack of access to those things which make for a quality of life, education, healthcare, housing, and so forth, interact with new problems or the revival of old ones, assuming new shapes. For example, I refer to such areas as the environmental crisis, a return to societies and states fragmented along identity lines, national, ethnic, or religious, racism, confrontations and competition for basic resources and for minimal state services, and employment, as we saw in recent weeks in South Africa. We are also entering a period of tough competition among many states for energy resources at a time when oil prices are higher than was imaginable even a little while ago. The problem is that at the human level, the level of the majority of people, the system is not working. The problem is also that our leaders have wasted the transition period between the end of the Cold War, when a world of opportunities was open to us, and the beginning of a new uncertain order when everything was changing. Attention could have shifted to the various political, religious, economic, and social problems of the developing world. Now, without the prejudice and distortion of the bipolar East-West rivalry, that frozen tableau of enemies that distracted our attention and paralyzed action for nearly a half century after World War II. The enemy now was not ideological, was not communism so much as the very conditions in which the majority of the world's population live, which can be summed up as economic inequality and a general lack of social justice. This includes physical afflictions such as disease, hunger, and resource deprivation that I have mentioned, as well as economic and social barriers to the achievement of a measure of well-being, illiteracy, lost educational opportunities, political exclusion, and of course, religious, ethnic discrimination, social and economic inequality all play their role. Of course, these problems indeed existed during and predated the Cold War. But now they should have been moved to the front burner. Instead, our attention has been again blurred, first by what in the United States was called narco-terrorism, and then later international Islamist or jihadist terrorism, which have slid in to occupy the space left by communism during the Cold War. This was accompanied also by an all-too-familiar readiness to apply a military response to world problems, what some have called the romance of the ruthless. This is the context of the problem we are raising here today. The old difficulties are still there, and the food crisis is simply demonstrating that they are reborn with new strength, while the international system, or the elite politics of relationships between states and the global economy, is evolving swiftly but with little signs of being able to deal with these problems. The social and economic and cultural challenges we face today in the developing world represent a recrudescence with new and more pernicious consequences of the old problems of poverty and international conflicts over resources and the disintegration of weak societies that we saw in the 80s, the 1980s, and the 1990s. And yet we have to tackle these challenges adequately. Indeed, the obsession with terrorism as the unique and primordial threat of the current century among certain sectors of the population and among certain states is already having a deleterious effect in the developing world. Placing counterterrorism at the center of national security has effectively subordinated the structural and ultimately more dangerous problems of ethnic and religious conflict, mismanagement of the environment, the struggle over resources, and the grinding poverty and persistent marginalization of the world's peoples. These problems, in my view, constitute the roots of present and future conflicts, and left unattended may bring perhaps terrible future political and economic consequences for us all. Let me just take a brief parenthesis here and say that while these views are captured in part from my work and the work of others in our team in Friday, in their entirety, they represent my personal views rather than strictly those of Friday, the institution for which I work. What are the consequences that we can already glimpse on the horizon? First, global instability. And we should think of these always in terms not just of the moral and political obligations we have outside of our respective countries, Portugal in this case, but also how these impact on our own countries themselves. That is, how they'd impact on Portugal. Global instability. In addition to these revolts over food prices, we see mass migrations, immigration problems, conflicts in some 30 countries, areas of intense conflict in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. The Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa, these were mentioned earlier as focal points of Portuguese foreign policy. Millions of displaced people and refugees in the Sudan. To cite only some examples, Somalia was on the BBC station that I watched just before I came here. Over a million people in Somalia have died in the last 7 years. In addition, there is the spread of radical jihadism and the threat of that late 20th, 21st century phenomenon, stateless and decentralized terrorism like Al-Qaeda. And its counterpart, which in my view is a mistaken response, and it's captured neatly in the phrase used by the United States to counter stateless international terrorism, the global war against terrorism, as if war was the answer in a way that it was the answer to aggressive actions by states during World War I or World War II, and not a problem that required a much more complex and nuanced response, which would not exclude the use of force, but would not rely on the metaphor of war and armies as the primordial response. Second, there's less room for maneuver for the U.S. in Europe today, less power in the West in conflicted areas of the world, as we're seeing in Iraq and Afghanistan, less ability to impose Western will. The Middle East is another example. The U.S., for example, has lost credibility to be an honest broker, and Europe, which should be playing a more active role, indeed, has as much interest in the Middle East, certainly if for no other reason than geopolitical, subordinates its natural interest to the U.S. transatlantic relationship. At least for now, Europe seems to have lost the initiative entirely in the region. And the situation is not helped by the anti-Lisbon Treaty vote in Ireland 2 weeks ago. Third, the multilateral system is under assault. This system, which was organized after World War II and synthesized by the UN, has been seriously but not irreparably weakened by Washington's arrogant unilateralism of the last 7 years. Its attitude of you're either with us or with the terrorists. Admittedly, the pendulum may be swinging back in the wake of the disaster in Iraq and the escalating violence in Afghanistan, and I'm referring now not to the possibility of a change in policy after November, but even the Bush administration itself has modified its rhetoric and its approach in dealing with Europe on these issues. But Europe has played its own role in undermining the international system of consultation and consensus in the effort to prevent conflict. And the European Union now has to deal with its own internal crisis of credibility regarding its common project. This despite the fact that the EU's project embodies those agreed-upon core values such as international cooperation, collaboration, solidarity among disparate parties, integration, unity without losing diversity, democracy with an effort towards social equality and respect for human rights. All lovely concepts, and we hope honored less in the breach than in the past. These are counter-tendencies that diminish, there are counter-tendencies, excuse me, that diminish this model, including internal fragmentation, chauvinistic policies toward immigrants, and a vision of private liberties over the collective good. My contention is that the European model is one of the strongest instruments that the European countries, the European Union, and specifically the case of Portugal, have as a part of its foreign policy apparatus. And there's a concern that this model may cease to be an example for those in the developing world. Special attention should be paid to the issues of peace and conflict in European foreign policies. In the current scenario, the possibility that there will be a new wave of armed conflicts is very high. These may assume new and different forms, for example, irregular guerrilla warfare among state actors and non-state actors confronting each other in dynamic and changing ways, as we have seen in Lebanon. Violent urban conflicts involving millions of jobless young people, the phenomenon of gang violence in Salvador, in San Salvador, the capital, and in Guatemala City. We see a similar phenomenon even in Liverpool and the streets of Moscow, as well as in the Palestinian territories. There are conflicts among poor residents and poor immigrants, as we've seen recently in South Africa. We are witnessing conflicts over natural resources as well, and more traditional wars over territorial control and national liberation movements, as we see in Palestine, which in turn, and I'm referring to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, includes resource conflict over land, obviously, and less well-known, over water rights. All of these conflicts far from being resolved. The conflicts inevitably result in violations of human rights and thus the possibility of more humanitarian interventions and perhaps more peacekeeping forces under the general principle of the responsibility to protect. Preventive action early on avoids the necessity of using more direct military force later on. Why should Portugal care? What instruments lie at hand? Portugal, like Europe, more so than Washington, continues to stress conflict prevention rather than reaction to fragile, failing, or failed states. The former focus is clearly a more complex and challenging proposition, that is, the one held more commonly in Europe. More so than in the United States, Europeans tend to address the issues of poverty and inequality more directly as root problems, rendering security a somewhat more contingent element. This emphasis on development irrespective of security, while modified in the post-9/11 world, continues a distinction that was also true in the Cold War. Within Europe, Denmark and Sweden, for example, have been more oriented toward development aid than, say, Spain or Portugal. Development aid is ultimately more important than achieving ceasefire or peace agreements, because of the high recidivism rate, that is, the return to conflict. Yet overall, Europe has followed all too closely the U.S. example of concentrating on the problem of terrorism and national security rather than development. I sometimes see these as three-tiered solutions in which security is at one level of almost total Western imposition, and I think of the case of Afghanistan. The next level is the collaboration in the effort towards state building. But the final product is really peace building, which is not state building. It's something that's much deeper than that and requires ultimately not only the consensus, but the hard work and development of the whole peace building process at the local level by the local nationals, with ultimately minimal input from outside actors like Europe. So security, state building, peace building is a continuum in which the United States has emphasized the first of it, and we would hope that given the trajectory and the ideological dispositions of many countries in Europe, there'd be a tendency to emphasize more the third element, the peace building element. And the idea now is, in my view, especially if there's a change of government in November or a change of direction in U.S. foreign policy, however slight, is that Europe and the United States work together to skew that part of the continuum toward the peace-building efforts. Half of the EU money still in Iraq is going toward the military, and only half toward multilateral aid. There's been a focus on, by the United States, and the Europeans have followed, on the countries that seem to represent, anyway, the greatest terrorist threat rather than countries greatest need, even though that is a short-sighted view of what would even be a security consideration in the immediate intermediate future. Finally, despite a growth in these fragile and failed states, which now number as many as 50 by some reckoning, and a ratcheting up of interest and attention to failed states after 9/11 as progenitors of terrorism, there's not much evidence overall of increased European budgets in the areas of aid to failed or failing states. Yes, Europe essays and promotes a modern, reasonable, if I may use the word civilized, democratic model. It displays its good face, promotes democracy, defense of human rights, contributing modestly to peace building and human security, and articulates its praise about the Millennium Goals, that is, the UN effort to reduce poverty. But it must do more. Of course, Europe should balance ideals with capacity, its political vision with instruments of disseminating it. An effective approach to conflict zones would combine feasibility with inspiration. While we may have to recur to coercion where and when it is absolutely necessary, there must always be an openness to negotiation. As John F. Kennedy famously advised, should never negotiate from fear, but never fear to negotiate. There must also be an understanding of local needs. And I'm very keen on this. I just returned from a peacekeeping conference in Paris in which there were several overriding issues or principles that received a consensus from the group, and one of them was the need to build peace at the local level. It cannot be imposed either from a barrel of a gun or even from an overwhelming onslaught of Western aid, as we are seeing, indeed, in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, a military policy has ended up shortchanging even security because the U.S.-led NATO effort ignored basic local needs. Tactics and strategies need to be aligned. If the overarching strategy is to win the hearts and minds of the combatants, then aerial bombing with collateral civilian damage is probably a poor tactic. In Europe, we must recognize the potential for hypocrisy. There is a selfish and self-serving tendency to close the gates against the barbarians, that is, to close off the immigrants searching for a better life, while trying to capture all the possible opportunities in the world from which those immigrants came. In the case of the much-applauded Millennium Goals, the money has been slow to come, and the industrial developed countries have been slow to comply. Europe and the U.S. still play the dual role of accommodating to the European reality of competition with other powers whose behavior does not necessarily mirror the EU. And I include the USA, China, and Russia, while repeating the lofty rhetoric always of democracy, human rights, etc. The question is, do we recognize these contradictions, and will we operate upon that rectification of that? A general comment, once again, about this axis of coercion versus attraction. It seems to me Europe can be a force to emphasize a sliding on that continuum toward the attraction end. The contribution Europe or Portugal can make to the world of conflict resolution and peace building is to project the European model and the use of so-called soft power, a term by, coined originally by the U.S. academic Joseph Nye, as instruments of persuasion rather than coercion. Europe and the EU may feel they lack power in foreign affairs, but power, after all, is the ability to get the outcome one wants. And in today's world, as the last 7 years have shown, the contexts of power are complex, and the U.S. had to learn this lesson again, not just military, but economic, political, and moral as well. And often it depends on the will to assert these elements of soft power. This includes especially the attraction, credibility, and legitimacy of the European model. A limited free market economy with state-guaranteed social justice and social security to soften the rough edges of capitalist inequality. Europe's ultimate power in international affairs rests on this model and the concomitant recognition of non-military aspects of peace building. The U.S. appears at this conjuncture to be in economic distress. The world is not static. China and India are certainly on the rise. Russia is back with political and military force, and its geopolitical and economic interests, especially through oil and gas resources, are allowing its influence to expand accordingly. The emerging nations, for example, IBSA, Brazil, India, South Africa, are increasing their economic and diplomatic clout in their areas of influence. There are shifts in the economic system toward more decentralization, regional alliances, and new hegemonies. For example, China and its sphere of influence, Iran in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. The global economic system, including trade and finance, seems barely controllable. Global privatization is preventing coordinated responses. For example, today, in facing the crisis of food shortage or intolerably high prices, the competition among buyers, sellers, and speculators and those who need the food is such that the multilateral organization's call for coordination goes unheeded. Okay. I am going to move toward a conclusion so that we can have some time for debate. In terms of the responsibilities of Europe, I'm going to summarize let me just say briefly that the Bush administration had previously masterfully played the fear card for internal political gain while exporting fear and anger rather than U.S., more traditional values of hope, optimism, and faith in the progress of humanity. Guantanamo became a more powerful symbol than the Statue of Liberty. This is going to shift. How much, we don't know. It will depend on the election, who wins. It will depend on what kind of Congress we have. We have scenarios running from almost no one is predicting a Republican Congress, so we're talking about a Democratic Congress with McCain or a Democratic Congress with Obama, but we're also contemplating a third possibility, which is an Obama election with a filibuster-proof Democratic Congress. That is what here would be called la mayoría absoluta, more than 60%. That is the best hope for perceptible shifts in U.S. policy. In light of the recent failures of hard power, the U.S. already appears ready to embrace the concept of soft power strategies. And here we would expect Europe and the United States to be working in a kind of new dynamic rather than at loggerheads as we have seen off and on over the last 7 years. At any rate, Washington must restore its alliances, partnerships, and multilateral institutions. Many have fallen into disarray in recent years as U.S. unilateralism took precedence over collaboration and cooperation. But Europe must be prepared for this shift and shift its own approach, which has allowed the United States in many of these cases to take the leading role. In conclusion, then, Europe, like the U.S., should be invested in addressing conflicts through the rooting and proliferating of a form of social democracy, that is, political freedom and representative government, together with local human security, and emphasize human security rather than national security, social justice, and reasonable opportunities for material progress. In the end, if the pursuit of democracy as an alternative to conflict is to be more than window dressing to disguise otherwise transparent hegemonic interests, it must aim for more than periodic elections. Above all, any true definition of democracy must incorporate a deeper structural definition in which the idea of social justice is embedded. That includes serious global efforts to reduce poverty, economic inequality, and marginalization, and promote balanced, integrated, environmentally sound growth. What all of us then should be striving for is sustainable democracy, that is, viable and long-range democracy, which affords ongoing economic development, political pluralism, and ultimately a sustainable human, not just national, security. And on that issue of security, a goal all too often sought only through military deployments rather than through the multiple peacekeeping instruments that we have at our disposal and which Europe knows it has at its disposal, even though it has not always used them. A road to peace paved by war and destruction, however superficially and immediately successful, needs to be challenged for the short-lived chimera that it is. Force may be necessary in given circumstances, I will be the first to admit. But the key here is to create solid foundations for an integrated, legitimate, and functional state, the end product of the effort to construct peace and construct or reconstruct fractured states. And these foundations can only be laid properly and soundly through an array of coordinated non-military means. Europe has the political culture and the historical and ideological framework to respond to the complexity of this challenge of modern conflict with an equally complex but integrated and coordinated set of strategies. In this regard, Portugal, as part of a European optic on conflict and peace building, can help lead the way. Thank you.
Dr. Robert Matthews, nós fomos aqui brindados com uma exposição muito articulada e muito rica sobre a alteração na natureza dos conflitos e, naturalmente, que esta exposição se articulará da melhor maneira com a seguinte relativa às novas realidades e diferentes atores. O Dr. Robert Matthews sublinhou um facto que nos interpela a todos, que é o uso da força militar para proteger civis. Hoje, grande parte dos conflitos, isso implica na nossa cultura de defesa e, nomeadamente, no conceito estratégico, na medida em que grande parte do recurso à força militar hoje é para proteger civis e, no nosso caso, da nossa tradição portuguesa, tendo nós uma longa experiência, uma doutrina própria em matéria de contra-insurgência, penso que o nosso contributo específico pode ser muito valorizado no contexto deste novo tipo de conflitos, de uso de força militar para proteger civis. O Dr. Robert Matthews falou também da alteração, portanto, do paradigma westfaliano, em que os conflitos se desenhavam apenas nas ações agressivas entre Estados. Há hoje novas realidades, novos atores, problemas que hoje são transversais num cenário que é de uma certa desordem ou anarquia internacional, onde não há já uma organização em termos de sistema bipolar e em que o chamado momento unipolar do sistema de relações internacionais também se está a dissolver com a emergência não só de novos atores, como também com a perda de capacidade de dissuasão do principal estabilizador do sistema de relações internacionais, que é os Estados Unidos. Apontou também para eventuais mudanças, que serão mais nuances que rupturas, dependente das próximas eleições presidenciais norte-americanas, e depois sublinhou a especificidade da política externa europeia e da União Europeia como soft power, como instrumento mais de persuasão do que coerção, e na necessidade de uma cooperação transatlântica, onde esta competência específica, este perfil específico da União Europeia possa ser valorizado. Eu acho que nos deixou uma série de pistas muito interessantes para reflexão e, nessa perspectiva, iríamos agora abrir o debate. Eu daria, em primeiro lugar, a palavra ao Dr. Ricardo Borges de Castro, da Universidade de Lusíada, que já se inscreveu, e, durante a resposta a esta questão, eu pedia que se registassem as outras inscrições, na medida em que, imperceptivelmente, teremos de encerrar este painel às 11h45. Portanto, muito obrigado, Dr. Ricardo Borges de Castro.
Thank you. I think I can speak in English if the speaker would prefer that. Thank you. Thank you for your talk. And I just had I'd like to ask you a question. When you mentioned the three-tier solution for actual conflicts, and you say that there's been a privilege by the U.S. in this case for security, then state building, and then peace building. My question is, and you would eventually prefer, as you said, it's been discussed, to start with the peace-building measures, or I don't know if it start, but to have a larger place in this context. I'm trying to apply that to real situations in real life, and let's talk about Darfur. How can actually this strategy of starting by peace-building, as a peace-building strategy, instead of providing security to the people that live in the refugee camps, to the women that are actually the ones that go out to get wood and to get all of these things that are raped. And so how can you actually, without providing them first security, can you actually build up to do the peace building? And then I just had another second question, which is, you were understandably very critical of some of the actions of your governments. America or the United States have a lot of good things also to give to the world. What are those good things, like academia and many others that you did not mention, that can be very, very relevant to try to bridge the gaps or bridge the the problems that sometimes Europeans, Americans, and anyone else in the world have regarding the U.S. So if you could elaborate a little bit on that also.
Sure.
Thank you.
Correct or restate what I was saying before about this continuous security, state building, and peace building. I don't mean to imply that peace building should necessarily be the first thing you do. It should be the goal, and it should be integrated as soon as possible in order to create sustainable peace. That's the key word here. Security alone is not going to provide the answer. I totally agree with you that the first order of business in Darfur is local security. I would also argue that the U.S. approach to security, and I know the case of Afghanistan best, has been an overarching military approach rather than a local approach to build police forces, judicial reform, local Afghan security forces, and so forth. And this has created a tremendous problem now in terms of both the credibility of the central government and the credibility of the Western mission there, the NATO mission, the ISAF mission. So that I think we have to distinguish even within security whether we're aiming for protecting our own national security, establishing some kind of a security at the level of the central government, but ignoring local security. And I would certainly say that the first order of business in Darfur is to provide local security. And that it's not being done. It's been shameful. The lack of effort in the area of security in Darfur. And I don't want to leave the misperception that I believe that we should be simply going out and putting aside our rifles or converting them into plowshares and starting with peace building. There are many situations in which the first order of business in order to gain the hearts and minds of the people that you're working with is to provide them with security. Everything else follows them. They don't have personal physical security. You can't talk to them about illiteracy. You can get, even food acquisition becomes secondary to the fact that you've got people murdering people in your village. Okay. As for the good things in the United States, I'd be the first to say there are many, and I'm a product of them. The openness of the society, which unfortunately doesn't always work perfectly, as we saw in the media campaign to pull us into a war where the journalism, I feel, did not operate under the principles of both a democracy and professional journalism in terms of questioning what was coming from the government. But in general, the system works there to create a relatively open society. I think the United States, and I think I did mention it, has in the past used these instruments, depends on who's in the government, the soft power instruments, the exchange programs. I didn't get to mention this because I cut this out because we were running out of time, but Europe also has many of these instruments at their disposal. And I think you'll see more of this. What's happened in the last 7 years is it's been an absolute afterthought. And when soft power was considered, it was always seen in Machiavellian terms. They sent somebody out in the job of public diplomacy, it was called. And she went around the Middle East just talking about how wonderful the United States was at a time when Al Jazeera was showing images of what was happening in Iraq every day. It didn't work. There had to be some kind of sincere approach. And my feeling is that there's much more of an awareness now and more of a convergence with a European optic in the offing, even with a McCain victory, although I'm much less confident that there will be major shifts in that direction. Let me just say one final thing on that, and that is that it's very counterproductive to eschew those values which we held dear and which we did promote along with anti-communism during the Cold War, for example. Human rights, our own internal democracy, respect for international law, all of these things have been tainted in the last 7 years in a way, on a very pragmatic level, that has made it difficult for us to promote democracy. And that becomes a security issue. If ultimately what you're after, as I said at the conclusion here, is a kind of deep structural democratic reform as a bulwark against violence and terrorism, and therefore a national security element, then you must have a credible democracy to serve as both a model and this is important, and as an instrument that's not going to, in fact, undermine, by association, the very people that you're trying to convert to democracy or reform. In other words, today, we know, in countries like Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, even in Iraq, the association with the United States has made it, Iran, another example, has made it more difficult for reformers and Democrats to sally forth because as soon as they were identified with the United States and its besmirched democracy, in their view, they lost credibility. So we've actually, it's been counterproductive to take the militaristic and unilateral approach that we have up until a couple of years ago. And you see shifts. So I'm not saying that this is a static situation. You already see shifts in Afghanistan as well, recognition of the past errors of the Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld years. Okay.
Professora Maria Carrillo.
Muito obrigada. Permitam-me que, apesar do tempo já estar apertado, felicite o Instituto de Estudos Estratégicos Internacionais, na figura do seu diretor, assim como a Assembleia da República, pela organização deste debate. E, naturalmente, felicito também o Dr. Robert Matthews pela sua exposição e pelas questões que nos suscitou. A mim suscitou muitas, no entanto, vou naturalmente, cingir-me e escolhi duas. Bem, para resolver conflitos, é preciso estar preparado para os resolver. Para isso, é preciso prever. O Dr. Roberto Matthews citou, para além da crise energética, a crise alimentar. Desde há muitos meses, e como leitora de revistas internacionais dedicadas à política internacional, tenho perguntado se é verdade que, desde há muito, a crise energética estava prevista. Eu lembro-me só, por exemplo, há 10 anos, do caso Parvin-Berger, no seu Next War, um dos cenários que desenhou foi precisamente o de, esperemos que não, claro, de uma guerra desencadeada por motivos de falta de energia, enfim, não vou citar o país para não causar aqui suscetibilidades, mas, de facto, isso estava previsto. Portanto, pelo que diz respeito às questões energéticas, os vários think tanks, sejam eles civis, civil, militares, militares, secretos, não secretos, etc., funcionaram. Quer dizer, talvez não tenha funcionado ainda muito bem a resposta, mas existia já uma consciência. O que é que se passou em relação à previsão da crise alimentar? É certo que a FAO vinha alertando há muito tempo, mas a sensação que nos dá a todos nós observadores é que os variedíssimos think tanks e as inúmeras luminárias internacionais não conseguiram prever esta crise, que poderá vir a estar, como muito bem disse, na origem de conflitos que depois vão necessitar intervenção militar, que era aquilo que nós não queríamos. Como muito bem disse também, o que nós queremos é desenvolvimento e queremos desenvolver, nomeadamente na Europa, a nossa capacidade de soft power. Não por ser soft power e porque os americanos tenham achado, ou, enfim, alguns autores americanos tenham achado que a Europa, depois do uso do hard power, devesse ir empregar o seu soft power. Bom, mas isso levar-nos-ia para outros caminhos. Portanto, gostaria que, de dentro do think tank, que eu muito aprecio e que, aliás, citei, aprofundasse nos poucos minutos que nos restam, nesta primeira parte, dissesse alguma coisa, o que é que pensa em relação a esta falha quanto à previsão da crise alimentar. Por outro lado, muito brevemente, o que é que pensa da possibilidade da organização de uma força de interposição para o Zimbábue.
Well, let me take the last part first. An intervention force in Zimbabwe, I don't have an opinion on, because I think it's a very complex situation there, and it's not clear to me that intervention force at this point would reduce violence or create more violence. It's a tinderbox, and it's been let go too long. It's been, my own opinion in reading of the ongoing crisis is that South Africa could have played a more constructive role and did not, and we're left with a mess there. But I think it's also part of your general question. You know, why did we not pay more attention to Zimbabwe? Why is Somalia on the back pages when a million people died? You know, we used human, when all the other rationales for invading Iraq disappeared, we used human rights as the rationale for invading a country. The Congo, 4 million people died. Why didn't we care about these things? And I think, I, as you were speaking, I wrote down, the will to understand seems to be missing, and it's why we don't predict the food crisis, because it's of secondary importance. You know, there's a phrase in Spanish, I'm not sure if it works in Portuguese, pero tenemos que relativizar el terrorismo y la seguridad nacional. We have to, is that okay? More or less. In other words, we have to place in perspective this obsession and recognize that most of the violence in this world today, whether it's death by hunger and malnutrition, whether it's disease, and just parenthetically, I remember statistics that Bill Gates just threw out, saying if we spent $1 billion in sub-Saharan Africa, 600,000 people wouldn't die of malaria this year. Now, $1 billion represents 3 days of expenditures in Iraq. So there's clearly a lack of will here to address these problems, because we have given a primary place of pride, so to speak, to national security and terrorism, where there is much, in quantitative terms, much fewer casualties in any given year than there are to hunger and disease and other local conflicts. There's an organization called the Oxford Research Group in England, and they put out a wonderful document, which it's an ongoing project, which seeks to re-emphasize what they believe are the real crises for the 21st century. And they include resource deprivation, things I mentioned in here. They include a disease. They include marginalization, poverty, inequality, as ultimately issues that are going to affect the world and our national security, individually as countries and as collectively as organizations like the EU or NATO, etc. And if we don't pay attention to these things, we will pay the consequences down the line, that we are foolishly wasting time now. And I think the food crisis is simply underscoring, in this day and age, with the tremendous powers of research, investigation, communication, why can we not? We can't predict typhoons, or if we do, we decide not to communicate the information. People die unnecessarily all around the world because of a lack of attention, concentration, and what I would say, a will to understand where the real problems lie. And again, I am not speaking just out of moral conviction. I want to make that clear. It is in our own pragmatic interest not to allow these problems to be subordinated and hidden by a distorted attention on, for example, national security alone. Thank you.
Tínhamos como última questão o Dr. Bruno Reis.
Thank you. I think it was a very interesting presentation that raised a number of issues. I was just looking at some kind of more concrete points, because one of the things that was mentioned was actually that independently of our prejudices, you always need this mix. You need security and you need aid. And you need, of course, you need both. If you are providing aid without security, the armed groups will take over or will actually destroy it or whatever. So what I was wondering, what are the implications of this in terms of your broader arguments? And specifically, are you arguing that Europe spends too much on the military still, because you actually mentioned, for instance, in Afghanistan, we are still providing too much aid actually to the military. Are we spending too much in military aid and actually in the military side of this? And would you argue that we should actually still increase our aid budgets, for instance, cutting our military budgets? Would this be a contribution for sorting out this kind of conflict? Or actually, does Europe need to do more also on the military side? And probably, and unlike the U.S., actually, Europe needs to do more, not so much on the aid side, but actually on the military side. And would you argue that there are some changes for specifically on the military side that Europe could do that would help Europe or a country like Portugal to contribute more to the solution of this kind of conflict? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm not an expert on European cooperation budgets or military budgets, and I'm certainly not going to say recommend that we cut or increase them either. I'm really talking about a qualitative direction here. Let me say also before I go on that as far as I'm concerned, the biggest culprit here, and I think again of this the case I know best, Afghanistan, is the United States, where we have spent 11 times as much on the military as we had on reconstruction and state building, and we're now paying the price for that approach. As I said, without even having attained, you'd think at least with that kind of ratio of 11 to 1, we'd at least get local security, but we don't have that yet. What we are seeing, though, is that the PRTs, for example, which are these groups that go out and provide both security and development aid, are now spending as much money on aid as they are on their security apparatus. So there seems to be a qualitative shift in thinking about the necessity to provide this aid. I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think you're absolutely right that it's a dynamic, but it's a dynamic that should not, as it has under certainly the first Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, has excluded really the notion of development as a primary goal. This U.S. State Department, which handles that, was almost cut out of both Iraq and Afghanistan in terms of contributing. But I think, in general, what I would say to your question about, you know, should we be spending more or less money, I think the enough of these cases that I know say to me that the issue is not just throwing money at the problem. The issue is how you're using it, how you're coordinating it, what the ultimate goals are, how they're integrated with security goals. And right now in Afghanistan, there is a body of opinion, it's a minority opinion, but it's an interesting body of opinion, that believes that less is more, that we actually should be cutting back because we are discrediting, we are delegitimizing, discrediting, and wasting the credibility of the central government, which in turn, as it loses credibility, discredits and delegitimizes the Western effort there because of the way, the quality of not just the military economic development nexus, but the quality of the economic aid itself, the way it's administered, the way it flows back. This is a piece of my talk that I didn't get to talk about. This whole notion of Europeans contributing in order that their NGOs get money, in order that their corporations and consultants get $200,000 a year, and the money flows back to Europe. Many Afghans look at, forgetting about the military, they look at the economic aid program as part of the corruption problem in Afghanistan. That's where I would put my first emphasis before talking about adding or subtracting from budgets. Thank you.
Queria agradecer uma vez mais ao Dr. Robert Matthews a sua excelente exposição e também a todos os participantes neste debate e felicitar-nos por termos cumprido rigorosamente o nosso horário, o que é, no fundo, a única função relevante do moderador. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado, agradeço a notável exposição do professor Robert Matthews e a notabilíssima intervenção do moderador, que aqui agradeço como um bom amigo e um excelente parlamentar e um grande conhecedor das matérias de política externa. Fazemos agora um intervalo para um coffee break de 5 minutos e já retomaremos os nossos trabalhos.